In the last few sermons leading up to the Passover, I've covered the 6 days leading up to the Passover, or the last days of Jesus' life. And then the Passover day itself, or the last day of Jesus' life, were actually 36 hours from the time that he woke up on the 13th, and it would be a 36-hour day for him in that sense. But my purpose in providing this series is to help give you a sense of the timing as best as I can with the gospel accounts, so you can have a timeline of the action. And you know, maybe I'm the only one weird enough that thinks this way, but I just think in that linear way sometimes, thinking that if I can establish a timeline, then it helped me put the events in order, and then I can associate the actions of the principal characters along with it. So if I'm the only one that thinks like that, then I'm getting a lot out of this series, but maybe it's helpful to you as well. I sure hope so. But I do find that having a timeline can clarify the individuals and the lessons that are associated with this time. And obviously, if you look at one account and then the other account in the Gospels, there is some overlap. So I'm not just strictly giving just, you know, the exactness of it. But more important than just the exactness is the events and the lessons that they teach us. So I hope that more than anything else, that that is something that rubs off. Now, we are really in one of the most important times of the year, the beginning of the days of salvation, you might say, the beginning in which God sets his hand to recover mankind and recover humanity from sin. Today, on the day after the Passover, the day after Jesus was put to death, let's review the actions and the principal characters in the days after Jesus' life. But in order to provide some continuity to the message, I've got to go back to the day of the Passover. And we'll pick up the story by backing up just a little bit to give some context before Jesus died, to fill in a little bit more history and background of that particular day. And we'll pick up the story in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 45. And all, obviously, this is a little bit of some repetition is good. I remember Mr. Armstrong always used to say, repetition is the best form of emphasis. And we repeat things over and over again, it does begin to stick. But we'll begin reading in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 45, and I'll come back to this. And I'm going to skip around a little bit, and that's maybe the beauty of having the this work for Mr. Anderson. Okay, it worked for me too. Look at that. All I have to do is snap the fingers and it happens. It's good. So in Matthew 20, I'll be skipping from this and coming back to it. So that's the beauty of being able to have it on the screen. And if you like to take notes, you can jot them down. I'll make this promise to you. Anytime you want my notes, it's probably going to confuse you even more if you ask for them. But I'll be happy to share them with you and I'll email them to you. But if you need that, but a lot of people like to take notes, and note-taking is a great skill, so good for you if you can do that. But otherwise, it gets a little bit fuzzy. But putting the scriptures up on the screen makes it easier for you to get them down in time because, look, I've sat for many, many years before I was a minister and, you know, had trouble keeping up, you know, putting all the scriptures down. So maybe this makes it a little bit easier thanks to technology. But in Matthew 27 and verse 45, it says, now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness all over the land. So an honest question is, when did this happen? And before I proceed, I'll note that there does seem to be a little bit of a conflict in the timing and the hours mentioned in the different gospel accounts. And just, you know, if you're just reading the scripture, and you know, you could be misled just a little bit. In Matthew's account, he notes this time period as the sixth and ninth hour. Generally, that would be recognized from the way the Jews would count time, from 6 hours from sunrise when it was daylight, because John wrote there's 12 hours in a day and 12 hours in a night, and that's how they looked at things. So generally recognized as 6 hours from sunrise, or from noon to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which would make sense because of the work of the Jewish leaders who wanted him off the cross before sundown. They wanted to have him crucified and killed prior to sundown. But in John 19, There seems to be a little bit of a contradiction. So how do we reconcile that? So we read in John 19 that Jesus appeared to Pilate at the sixth hour. So how could he have been on the cross and be in the middle of crucifixion while appearing with Pilate? In John 19 and verse 13, we read that when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover. Actually, as John wrote several times, the Jews' Passover, they did not keep the Passover as we did. They kept it on the 15th, beginning of the 15th, which they hadn't arrived at yet. But it was the preparation day for the first day of unleavened bread, which would be today. But now in verse 14, it reads, there was the preparation day of the Passover, and about the sixth hour, he said to the Jews, behold, your king. I explained in the previous sermon that this would have happened in the very early hours of the morning, probably around 6 a.m., but now it seems as though it's a different time. How do you reconcile this? You could actually, just wondering about it. So the question is, how do we reconcile what seems to be an apparent contradiction in the accounts as far as the timing is concerned? Because if John is keeping time as the other gospel writers, then according to his account, Pilate was confronting Jesus at noon, which is how the Jews would have registered timing with 12 hours a day, as I mentioned. So how do we resolve this apparent contradiction? This is part of the reason that I want to create a chronology for you of the last 36 hours of Jesus' life to help answer this conundrum. Now we'll read in backing just up just a bit more to Luke chapter 23, Luke 23, verses 13 through 25. Luke 23, verses 13 through 25. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, said to them, this is a small, select group of people, would have included perhaps the entire Sanhedrin, all the scribes and the Pharisees, the religious leaders, and everybody associated with them, their witnesses, and so on and so forth, but it wouldn't have been a group of thousands of people or even hundreds. It would have been a large group of people, but it would have been in the very early morning. You, as we'll see, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people, and indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning the things which you accuse him. Verse 15, no, neither did Herod, for he sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him. Okay, you want it? You want me to punish him? I'll beat him. I'll beat him, I'll chastise him, and then let him go. For it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast. And they all cried out at once, saying, away with this man, release to us Barabbas, one who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. The other accounts say that he was a robber, and he was a robber too, and I didn't use this account in the last message, but he was actually a murderer. That was the worst crime that he had committed. He was guilty of a capital crime. Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, he wanted to do it, again called out to them, but they shouted, crucify him, crucify him. Then he said to them the third time, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. So that's why I mentioned on the Sabbath, this past Sabbath, in the previous sermon, that Pilate hoped that scourging him would be enough, but it wasn't, as we know. Verse 23, but they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison, but he delivered Jesus to their will. A lot of times we think, well, the Romans killed Jesus Christ, but it was actually at the behest of the leadership of the Jews, the religious Jews of that time. And they were the ones that were responsible, as we can clearly see. The prefect of the entire area of Palestine wanted to allow him to go. Now, he should have let him go, right? But then you'd have an uprising on your hand. Now, Luke 22, we don't have time to go to this chapter today, but Luke 22 records the arrest, at midnight, and then two trials that happened by the council that the Sanhedrin took place from midnight until roughly 5 to 6 a.m., and then they brought him to Pontius Pilate, and we've just read of that particular action right there. So they brought Jesus to Pilate around sunup, and so when John writes about the sixth hour, there's no other conclusion that you can come to. He must have been using the Roman reckoning of time, which would have been, as we look at it today, from midnight. Because this morning, when my alarm went off at 6 o'clock in the morning, it was from midnight, right? And that is the same way that we look at time today. So he must have been using the Roman reckoning of time, just as is done in this time. So it's 6 in the morning, and the other gospel writers show that they were using the Jewish reckoning of time, counting from daylight. That's how this apparent conundrum is solved. Actually, about 50 years ago, about this time of the year, as a matter of fact, when we were sitting in freshman Bible class, Dr. Meredith was covering this, and even before that, we have covered this particular question for about 80 years, about eight decades or so, and come up with the same thing. Now, many other scholars agree with what we have taught, that there was just a difference in how the gospel writers, depending on the time in which the book was written, would count time and give that. So our teaching and practice has been consistent for many, many years, and this is one of several questions that have come up over the years regarding timing, about when Jesus sat down with his disciples to eat the Passover, and what happened during that entire time. And these are questions that we have covered for many, many years, and not just written in a booklet, not just, you know, said, hey, read this and obey it, but actually covered it in depth. I mentioned several weeks ago that in United Church of God, we began with the premise that we would move forward with consensus. And if you're a member of United Church of God, then by so being here, you agree with that particular procedure, because otherwise there's no other, there are other processes. I remember years ago when a man came to me with a question and he said that, oh, no, I was just told I was wrong, and, you know, I was told to shut up about it. And I said, I hope that that didn't really happen in that way. But I said, if it did, you know, let's address it. And sure enough, he submitted to me his ideas. I submitted them to headquarters, as we called it then. And I know Mr. Armstrong looked at it, and he was the one that would look at it, but he gave it to Dr. Hay to evaluate. And then Dr. Hay gave a 14-page analysis on this individual's ideas and papers. And that's the only time that a paper like that has been submitted to me, so that it could be submitted to, you know, the higher church authorities. But I will make this promise to you: submit ideas, and I will faithfully and dutifully send them to the Home Office, to what we have a doctrinal committee. It's not just guys, most of them are not even employed by the church. They are ministers, capable ministers. But I will say this, that I promise to you that if you've got anything that you need to submit, or you think that our practice or our teaching is wrong, put it down on paper, because that's the only way it can actually be organized and reviewed and looked at, and then we'll move in consensus. If the church and the church authorities and the ministry agrees with you, then good, we'll move forward and we'll all be enlightened, and that would be great. And even if you don't feel like you can write it, I've got a website, I'm a pretty good writer, and even if I disagree with your conclusions or ideas, I'll put it down in paper for you, let you review it first to see if it accurately reviews and is accurate to what you want to say, and then I will submit it and do so. I promise you that. I'd be happy to do that. That's just for the future, in case anything like this comes up or questions come up, because that's the way we began. We had come out in 1995 of a situation in which our whole church organization was taken over by heretics. And they were forcing us to believe something or to practice something that we did not want to do. We didn't want to give up the Sabbath day. We didn't want to give up the holy days. We didn't want to give up keeping the Passover or anything that we had held so dear and that had instructed us. And so I know that not everybody was around at that particular time, but that's when we began this review process so that these things, that any questions could be addressed in an adequate way. And you know, that's that. I know that a lot of issues have been dealt with in that way. And here's the thing: if you submit something, like even you know, I've written things, I've submitted things. If people don't agree with our conclusion, you know, that's one thing. But to not do anything about it when you have a sincere desire to make a change, you know, that's on you as an individual. So I'll just say that. But this is just one little minor area, and I think most of the commentators and scholars agree with our teaching that the gospel writers were just using different methods of counting time. Otherwise, you just get really confused. And that's not the only criteria, but really getting back into the context of the scriptures is where the best criteria is that. But more than anything, getting all the scriptures of the encounter that Jesus had with Pilate helped shed light on the context and the timing of the event. So now let's go back to Matthew chapter 24 and verse 45. Now from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, there was darkness all over the land. So looking at it from the way the Jews would count time, this would be from noon until 3 p.m. And 3 p.m. is when our best guess, or around that time period, as to when Jesus was actually killed. Now darkness fell over the land. Now, with all of the hysteria that has gone on over an eclipse a week or so ago, you know, this was, by people that really don't know, there's a couple of eclipses every year. But all of a sudden, in the news media, you probably read that this was some kind of biblical event. No, it's a natural occurrence. They happen all the time. Eclipses happen every year. This was just an eclipse that happened to go over the United States. And, you know, somebody, I was even reading one site where somebody, there was a certain city that seven times it would go over this same name city in different states or something. I mean, it was like, okay, so what does that mean? Nobody knows what it means, but anyway, was it Nineveh or something? Does anybody remember that? What was it? Nineveh? Okay. It was going, I didn't check it out. I don't even know if it's true, but I can say this with some assurance. There is no biblical meaning or prophetic meaning to this eclipse, okay? Nor is there ever going to be, a biblical prophetic implication of a red heifer. So look for that in the website, but had so many other things to do, haven't had time to finish that particular article. Anyway, this was not a solar eclipse. This was a supernatural event that was caused by God. What did it mean? We read in Amos chapter 8, Amos 8 verses 9 through 10. Now I'm not saying this is a direct fulfillment exactly of the darkness coming over the land at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, or the last 3 hours of his crucifixion, but it's perhaps a first fulfillment of this particular time. It shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord God, that I will make the sun go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in broad daylight, and I will turn your feasts into mourning, and all your songs into lamentation. I will bring sackcloth on every waist and baldness on every head. I will make it like mourning for an only son, and its end like a bitter day. And that did happen that particular day. I'm not saying it was the only time that this scripture will be fulfilled, but darkness covering the land was an indication of God's judgment, and it was God's judgment on the religious figures of the day. And God indeed was judging the event that was taking place, the crucifixion of his house, wrought by those people who were responsible, the Jewish authorities, not the Jewish society, but specifically the wicked, incorrigibly wicked Jewish leaders who brought Jesus to death. The darkness showed God's contempt for their practice and what they had done. And in Matthew chapter 27 and beginning in verse 51, we see some other significant events that happened right at that very time, things that we should not ignore. So that's why I'm backing up during the message today. Matthew 27 and verse 51, "Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And the earth quaked, and the rocks split, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many." Now, a little comment regarding the punctuation of the verse. This does not mean just because somebody added a comma here at this particular time in verse 23, that doesn't mean that after, you know, that they stayed in the graves, they were resurrected and they stayed in the tombs until after the resurrection. Just eliminate the comma, as, you know, sometimes punctuation, English is added and it's not really necessary. But coming out of the graves, after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many. So they were resurrected, and then, you know, a few days later, they went into the city and they appeared to many during that entire time. So the most important thing is these few verses are jam-packed with action and information that began to take place the instant that Jesus died, and it's all very, very important. Let's first of all deal with the significance of the temple being torn asunder. This was a supernatural event. The doors to the area that we would call the Holy of Holies were opened, and the temple veil itself that separated the holy area, or the place where everybody could go, and the place where only the high priest could go, was just torn asunder. So think about this. What did that mean for us, and what does it mean eventually for all of mankind? The book of Hebrews helps us to understand in several places. We're going to read, first of all, in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 19, Hebrews 6 and verse 19, it says, "This hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which enters the presence behind the veil, where the forerunner has entered for us, even Jesus, having become high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." And then moving forward a bit into Hebrews chapter 9, it's also referenced there. In Hebrews 9 and verse 3, "And behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, the Holy of Holies, which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant." The holiest of all is what we also call the Holy of Holies. And it was previously only accessible by one person in all of humanity, and that was the high priest, first Aaron and then his descendants, whoever the high priest was. And he could only do that one time a year on the Day of Atonement. So now that veil is split in half, and that signifies that we have access to that holy area, and mankind would have access to that holy area for the first time in history, not just that physical sanctuary, but in the third heavens. In Hebrews chapter 10 and verses 19 through 21, it says, "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, it made possible that way by a new and living way, which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God." So there was a supernatural act that began at 12 noon in the middle of Jesus' crucifixion, because going by the timeline, going by the gospel accounts, he began to be crucified about 9 a.m. that morning, was on the cross for 6 hours. The supernatural act of the veil being ripped in two accomplished this. It made the throne room of God available for us. A very excellent message in the sermonette on concentrating on putting sin out and then putting on righteousness as well. Putting out leaven, eating of unleavened bread. offense and defense, just a great analogy. But in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 16, we read, "Let us come, therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." So with the eternal sacrifice of Jesus Christ having been made, there was no longer any need for a sacrificial system. And the church never offered sacrifices from the time of that Passover lamb on the beginning of the 14th. They would not participate in the sacrificial system any time afterwards. Nor would there ever be a need for a physical temple. There was a need for a physical temple, and that's why a second temple was built and completed in 515 BC. There would be a temple that Jesus would come to both physically, and he would give instruction from that temple and during that temple. That was no longer necessary because it was, you know, it was, let's face it, it was finished by Herod the Great, who wasn't even a Jew, and it was embellished, and it wasn't really Solomon's temple, which had been destroyed, and it had been reconstructed. And you know, the disciples said to Jesus on Mount of Olives, "Hey, look at that, a great, incredible edifice, the temple." And he said, "You know, it's going to be torn down. It's all going to be knocked down." So this act, the splitting of the temple veil, made the actions of those Jews who were bringing lambs to the temple at the same time that Jesus Christ was pronounced dead an obsolete act. Null and void, as well as anything that the religious leaders would attempt to do. And as Amos says, and other scriptures show, their sacrifices were an abomination in God's sight. Notice Isaiah chapter 66 and verses 3 and 4 certainly seems to indicate that God had foretold that there would be a time in which these acts done by evil people, they were doing, quote, right things, but with an evil attitude. Isaiah 66 says, "He who kills a bull is as if he who slays a man," because no sacrifice is going to be worthy in God's sight if it's done in a bad attitude. And so that would be the case during Jesus' day when they were offering lambs, but ignoring the lamb of God and putting a man to death. "He who offers a grain offering as if he who offers swine's blood. He who burns incense as if he who blesses an idol. Just as they have chosen their own ways and their soul delights in their abominations, so I will choose their delusions and bring their fears on them. Because when I called, no one answered." That was true during Jesus' ministry. "When I spoke, they did not hear." That was true because Jesus spoke to them and they did not listen. "But they did evil before my eyes and chose that in which I do not delight." Christ said, "I will have mercy and not sacrifice." Attitude is so very important. They had ignored the Lamb of God, and the religiosity and the ritual that they had was loathsome to God and unnecessary. The opening of the Holy of Holies, along with a great earthquake, with great stones and rocks splitting. We read this, we can read over it, but earthquakes are oftentimes, they happen, they're natural events. This obviously wasn't a natural event, just a coincidental thing that happened. This was also a judgment of God. And not only did it cause the temple veil to be split in two, but it very likely caused a lot of damage in the temple that day. So much so that it's very possible that the temple itself had been left ceremonially unclean, and any plan or action of the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sanhedrin to sacrifice lambs at the table was probably not only done null and void from a standpoint of God, it was probably not even able to be done. And perhaps this was God's way of emphasizing that there would only be one sacrifice that day, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And their observance of Passover, which would begin at the wrong time anyway, was canceled. Canceled by God by a supernatural intervention. Now let's go back to Matthew chapter 27 and verse 54 and pick up the story once again. Matthew 27 and verse 54. So when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Now that is amazing. A Roman centurion had the rank in today's army or today's, you know, there'd be counterparts in our armed services and other foreign services, probably about the rank of a captain, but maybe even higher depending on how long someone had been in service. And in this case, a centurion would be over 100 men. He would have command over 100 men, and there would be in a Roman, I think it's a battalion, there would be 6,000, so there would be 60 of these, 60 centurions within each battalion of a Roman army. I think that's the way it is. But at any rate, it would be roughly equal to that of captain in a modern army or armed service, or sometimes even above. But mainly, though, Matthew records that this Roman soldier and all those who were with him recognized the divinity of Jesus Christ as these events were happening around them. And it was only about a quarter of a mile from Golgotha to the temple, so they could see everything that was happening with the earthquake and the darkness and everything that was happening at that particular time. And we don't know whatever happened to this man and his fellow soldiers, but it was a very powerful witness to them on that very day. And for them to proclaim that this was an act of God and that this was the Son of God is profound indeed. Earthquakes, again, although they're natural events, obviously this one was one of God's intervention, and it emphasized God's judgment on the land. I've mentioned that we're told that the graves were opened, many saints were resurrected, appeared to many, and it's very brief, and we don't know anything else about these folks. But the effect that this must have had in the establishment of the New Testament church later on, weeks later, must have been very profound. And maybe even some of them were part of the 120 who would be a part of the true church of God beginning at Pentecost in 31 AD. Now back to the action of Matthew 27 and verse 57. After the death of Jesus Christ, which we covered several days ago, death by impaling of a Roman spear, it says, "Now even when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who himself had also become a disciple of Jesus. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be given to him, and when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in clean linen cloth and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a large stone against the door of the tomb and departed. And Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the tomb." Now, in Mark's account, it shows that Joseph took courage. It must have taken courage to go to Pontius Pilate and do this. Now, the Jewish leaders wanted to make sure that Jesus was killed, and obviously he was in the tomb prior to sunset on that particular day. His body was wrapped by Joseph of Arimathea in linen with myrrh and aloe and buried in a new tomb. And this happened as Wednesday evening, Nisan the 15th approached. It was the preparation for the annual holy day. The next day is mentioned Thursday. This year in 31 AD, Nisan the 15th would have been a Thursday, and it would have been, as we count the time, April 6th. That's the best guesstimate. In Matthew chapter 27 and verse 62, we read, "On the next day, which followed the day of preparation, prior to the holy day, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together to Pilate, saying, 'Sir, we remember while he was still alive how that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise, therefore command that the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say to the people, he is risen from the dead. So the last deception will be worse than the first.'" I'm sure Pilate was fed up with these people by this time. You have a guard. You know, they had their own soldiers. They had a guard. You go your way. You make it as secure as you know how. I'm not going to take the blame if something happens. You do it. So they went. They made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. So the chief priests, the Pharisees, they visit Pontius Pilate. They're afraid that Jesus' disciples will steal his body and claim that he came back from the dead. They had no desire to do that. The disciples were fearful of the Romans. They were fearful of the Jewish authorities, but at this time, as other scriptures show. So the garden tomb is made secure. They make sure that they put their own guard to the task. It's all sealed. The guard is placed. And at sunset, that holy day ends, Thursday. Only a brief mention is mentioned about the next day, which would be Friday, April the 7th. It's probably a little easier to see this on times when we have had Passover beginning on a Tuesday evening and then having Wednesday as the Passover and Thursday the first holy day. Sometimes on the Roman calendar it does happen that way, but I think you get the point. Now Mark chapter 16 and verse 1, it says, "Now when the Sabbath was passed," and that Sabbath would have been the holy day. The Sabbath would have been Thursday, the day before, the high holy day, the day that we are keeping today. "When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices that they might come and anoint him." Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, they prepare spices for the body of Jesus. They also make preparation to rest on the weekly Sabbath, which would begin at sunset. Now, Saturday, which would be April the 8th, or Nisan the 17th. Late in the afternoon on the weekly Sabbath, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary check on where Jesus is buried. Just before sunset, on the Sabbath, to fulfill the only promise that he made of his messiahship, and the only sign of his messiahship that he would give to the religious leaders, is that, like Noah, he would be in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. That would be 72 hours. So late in the afternoon on the weekly Sabbath, Jesus Christ was resurrected from the dead. He was put into the tomb, and he would be in the tomb for that period of time. Not from the time of his death do we count the 72 hours. We count the time that he was placed in the tomb, and he would remain there for 72 hours. So after spending precisely 3 whole days and 3 whole nights from sunset Wednesday to sunset Saturday in the tomb, then Jesus is resurrected. On Sunday, April 9th, we'll pick up the story in Mark 16 and verse 2. Mark 16 and verse 2, "No such thing as a Sunday resurrection, but very early in the morning on the first day of the week," and that would be what we call Sunday, "they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. And they said among themselves, 'Who will roll away the stone from the door of the tomb for us?' But when they looked up, they saw the stone had been rolled away, for it was very large. And entering the tomb, they saw a young man clothed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, 'Do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him? But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him as he said to you.' So they went out quickly and fled from the tomb, for they trembled and were amazed." I mean, how would you not be if you were there during that particular time? "And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid." In verse 9, Now when he rose, early on the first day of the week, he appeared to Mary Magdalene. You have to understand the tense. He had already been risen. He rose 72 hours after he'd been put in the tomb at the end of the Sabbath. "Out of whom he had cast 7 demons. She went and told those who had been with him, as they mourned and wept. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they did not believe. So early in the morning, Mary Magdalene, the other women, they go to Jesus' tomb with the spices that they had prepared for his body. When the women arrive at the tomb, they see the angel had moved the stone, sitting on top of it. The angel tells the women to enter the tomb. In a tomb, they see a young man, another angel, clothed in a white robe, sitting on the right, and he tells them Jesus is gone. He's resurrected. He tells the women to inform the disciples, especially Peter, that Jesus is alive. So Mary Magdalene runs to tell Peter and John what had happened. Then Peter and John run to the tomb. John modestly says that he outran Peter, and you can read that for yourself. And they see that no one's in the tomb, but they see the cloth that had been put over his head had been neatly folded and placed by itself. At 9 o'clock, Jesus ascended to the throne of God the Father to be accepted as the perfect sacrifice for the sin of the world. You can read of those accounts in the various gospel accounts where he told Mary not to touch him before he had risen. But about 9 o'clock, thereabouts in the morning on Sunday, then he rose to the Father to appear as the type of the wave sheaf offering to the Father. And we'll get to that as we go into the days of the Pentecost later on. He comes back to earth, miraculously appears to disciples who in John chapter 20 were now in fear of their lives from the Jews, and they were in a closed room. In John chapter 20 and in verse 19, we'll pick up the story. Then the same day at evening, that would be Sunday, the first day of the week, then the same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in the midst of them and said, "Peace be with you." That would be both electrifying and maybe even a little bit horrifying for that to happen. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Supernaturally, Jesus appeared in the flesh once again, which a spirit being can do. We saw that with the example and many examples in the Old Testament as well. And even retained all of the wounds, or at least several of the wounds, so that they could understand for their benefit, so they could understand that it was indeed him. Then the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. And Jesus said to them, "Peace be to you. As the Father has sent me, I also send you." And when he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." Now, in verse 24, often a misunderstood sequence, sadly, for the individual that is mentioned, but we'll read it anyway. "Now Thomas, called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples therefore said to him, 'We have seen the Lord.' So he said to them, 'Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe.'" This shows the specificity with which Jesus was crucified. He was nailed to a cross. His disciples had seen it, and they understood it. "And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas with them. And Jesus came, and the doors being shut, and stood in the midst, and said, 'Peace to you.' Then he said to Thomas, 'Reach your finger here, and look at my hands, and reach your hands here, and put it in my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing.'" Everything that we think and everything that we say is recorded and known of God. I think that's very evident by this example. There is no closing off of anything that we do, say, or hear, good or bad. Jesus said to him, "Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen yet have believed." That's you. "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, that believing you may have life in his name." And really, that is what is important. It's not just believing, as some faiths bring it out, and that's all you have to do, but it's important to believe. It's really important to believe and to understand. And we've reviewed for several weeks now some of the symbols. We've reviewed the topic of leaven and unleaven, sin and righteousness. We've gone over these things for many, many years. Coupled with belief, these are very powerful motivators for a Christian. So this is a chronology of the events of the day Jesus died and shortly afterwards. It's not every single one. Can't pack it all into one entire sermon. But these things reaffirmed his divinity, his messiahship to his disciples. Thomas' example is left in the record, not to be an embarrassment to him, as many have made of him, but for us, because we're those who haven't seen, yet we believe. The early New Testament church began with many of these individuals, believers yet flawed, not perfect, but courageous in many instances in the days ahead. They would move forward, they would continue to understand God's purpose in the weeks ahead, and my hope and prayer is that we all do the same.